Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease. Welcome to our newest episode of Energy in Action. I want to start this episode by thanking Skylar, our guest today, for sharing her story with us. Like so many of us with mitochondrial disease, there are many stories within our journey that bring up painful moments. So I want to thank you from the get-go for your willingness to talk about your past and your present with us today. So welcome, Skylar.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here and share my story. Thank you for giving me a platform.
Of course, of course. We connected at a Mito support group. We were paired together, and I didn't know eventually we would be working together in this way, but I really appreciate our connection, and I've really valued hearing your story, and I think that you sharing your journey with our listeners will be very meaningful and important for them to hear. So thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
So it seems appropriate to start with your early years, as it often does with these personal journey stories. So I'm hoping you could tell us just about your childhood and how early you were diagnosed and feeling symptoms and things like that.
Well, when I was born, I did have some health issues. As everybody, I was born with a hole in my heart, which everybody does, but mine took longer to heal. It took a minute. And then my mom also, like, I remember her telling me when I was younger, I couldn't cry or like stress out because it was too much stress on my heart. And then I had some developmental delays, as in I didn't walk until I was 3 years old. And I didn't eat solid food until I was 4 years old. Until then, my parents would blenderize my food, which it's called a blenderized diet. Some people got on me at a other podcast for saying blenderize.
But that is the real word.
Yes, it is the real word.
Well, you would know more than me. You've done it. I haven't. So I'm going to let you go with that.
Yes. And then I had a lot of leg problems. I got diagnosed with peripheral neuropathy by the age of 6 years old. And I continued to have like a lot of problems with my legs, like a lot of nerve pain and everything. So they started testing me for mitochondrial disease at that point. And at 6 years old, I had a muscle biopsy. And as everybody with mitochondrial disease knows, there's like those medications called mitotoxic medications. But since mito is such a spectrum disorder, there's some mitotoxic medications that some people can have. And then there's some that like other people can't, like you're not supposed to have lactated ringers. And I respond fine to those and everything. It's just to each their own. But since it's mitotoxic, try to stay away from it. But when they sedated me for my muscle biopsy, they gave me propofol, which I reacted very poorly to. There was a code for me and a bunch of resuscitation team. And at this point, I was already ventilized because I was just waking up from surgery. And then it took me 6 hours to fully wake up. I remember waking up two times during it, though, as in there's one time I woke up and I was surrounded by a bunch of doctors and nurses. And then I went back to sleep, I remember. And then I woke up again and it was just my mom in the room and she looked very stressed. But unfortunately, they didn't take enough tissue in that muscle biopsy. And it came back inconclusive, so we didn't know. And then after that muscle biopsy, I just had a bunch of physical therapy, occupational therapy, to where I still had leg pain, and I still had a lot of chronic fatigue and migraines and stuff like that. But it got to where it was manageable at this point, to where they stopped testing me for mitochondrial disease because I was stable when I was 8 years old. I was even able to play soccer, and my parents were just so proud of me. Like, their entire Facebook was just me with like soccer pictures because they were just so proud because of my previous medical history. They weren't sure on how I would do, if I would ever walk again or stuff like that. And I was playing soccer for a year So that was really nice. I was in public school, but I did miss a lot of school because of leg pain or fatigue and stuff like that.
If they had taken enough tissue in that initial muscle biopsy, would things have become more conclusive at an earlier age for you?
Probably, because I still did have low times to where I missed like a week of school at a time to where I had to do kind of half and half, like half home and then half normal school. And I felt like if I did get the proper treatment, as in like the mitochondrial cocktail, which is just vitamins, that at that time I would be doing better. But yeah, that is a really good question. But at the age I was pretty stable. Like I did miss a lot of school and I still had symptoms, but they weren't completely debilitating. And then at the age of 11, both me and my brother caught a stomach virus when I was 11, he was 13. And he recovered within like 3 days, 4 days, and then he went back to school. And I just kept throwing everything up. I couldn't keep anything down and I was losing a lot of weight. And then about like 3 weeks passed, my mom was just trying with like nutritional shakes and everything. And then it got to the point where I was really underweight. And then that was causing issues of then more fatigue and just it was a lot. I developed a lot of abdominal pain from it.
So your brother recovered from the stomach bug like a typical kid would. And you are continuing with the symptoms and it's not going away.
Correct. My symptoms continued. And then it got to the point where I was really underweight. I was really just not doing great. So my mom took me to the hospital. They eventually did an outpatient gastric emptying scan with barium. It was really disgusting. And they had me take the barium, which is like an element, and it shows on x-rays. I used to think it was radioactive, but it's just like an element. It tasted like chalk. It was so gross. And that showed gastroparesis and also reverse motility, which gastroparesis is delayed stomach motility or paralyzed stomach for some people. And then reverse motility means when my stomach would try to work and it would push food down, my small intestine would just regurgitate it back up into my stomach. So that's why I would throw up food that I ate like 3 days before or something like that. I also forgot to add that my mom and my brother were diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome at this time. It's a genetic connective tissue disorder. For me personally, I have classical. So it just causes like joint pain, subluxing, and then just other issues like that. And at this time, they continued to try the nutritional shakes, but it wasn't working. So they tried one more gastric scan, which I ate like a radioactive egg, and it showed the exact same thing. So they placed a feeding tube at this time. It was an NJ tube, which it goes up your nose, down your throat, past your stomach, into your small intestine, into your jejunum. And then I was getting feeds through there, but it would still make me pretty nauseous.
So at this point, mitochondrial disease is just it's not a topic.
It isn't, but as I don't feel better after the feeds, it starts to be brought up again.
Uh-huh.
And then...
So this is around when you're like 8 or 9?
This was when I was 11.
Oh, 11. Okay.
Yes. And then I still was not feeling better. And then my fatigue got really bad and my pain in my legs got worse. And then I started developing very bad abdomen pain. And I had to go back into my wheelchair because I could no longer tolerate walking long distances. And I kept having spouts to where my legs would just give out. Like I would be walking in the grocery store and next thing I know, I'm on the floor. And then also during this time, I got diagnosed with POTS, which is postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, meaning I get really dizzy, really easy. I need more hydration, blood flow issues. It's an autonomic nervous system dysfunction. And then during this time, I was still on feeds. I could not tolerate anything by mouth. So I had a GJ feeding tube surgery placed, which is a surgical feeding tube in your abdomen. And mine went into my stomach and then also into my jejunum. And then I had a port placed, which is a central line It's an inserted device that you, quote, access with a needle whenever you need it. And then I got that for fluids. And then I had a time where there was a home health nurse and my parents were all around. He went to the bathroom. He came back. And in the central line, there's a thing called a microclave. And the microclave basically is a barrier for germs. And so it's less easy for germs to go into the port because the port goes into your bloodstream right by your heart. And without a warning, nobody had a mask on. It was me, the nurse, my mom, and my dad in the room. And he was just there to teach my mom how to properly take care of my central line, which is ironic because he opened the microclave with no warning, no gloves, nothing. And then my mom was like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing? And he just put it back on, which when you take a microclave off, everyone's supposed to have a mask so no germs go in there. And then also you are supposed to have gloves on, of course. And then also you're supposed to clean it and put a new one in. And then I was home and within 24 hours, I was running pretty high fevers. They went up to like 102. And I was feeling really, really bad. I would never ask my mom, like, can you please take me to the hospital? Because it wasn't a great place. And then I went into the hospital and I turned septic at this time because it still had like probably 30 hours after or something like that. And I was septic and it was absolutely terrible. I had to get my port removed because they couldn't get the infection away with just antibiotics. And then the infection actually came back even though my port was removed. And then I had to be on more antibiotics during this time. Since I was on two courses of heavy IV antibiotics, I developed C. diff, which is an infection of your colon, and it was absolutely miserable from all the antibiotics. So not only did I have to recover from sepsis, which is absolutely terrible, I can't even describe it, I also had to recover from C. diff. And it was terrible. So I had a PICC line placed for a few weeks to give antibiotics at home. And then I got the PICC line removed because I just had my central line for fluids. So they started incorporating more Pedialyte through my feeding tube to give me more fluids because I still couldn't take it by mouth. And then the C. diff was making me extremely sick. I was losing weight. I wasn't tolerating my feeds as in like malnutrition from it. Malabsorption, my bad. I didn't absorb my feeds properly. And then I had a feeding tube. It was double. So one went into my jejunum, small intestine, and the other went into my stomach. And for my stomach one, I would use it if I was really nauseous to drain the contents in my stomach because it would help. And my formula was once again coming out of my stomach because of my reverse motility. It got really bad. So we had an insurance change at this time, and on the insurance card, it said a specific hospital. So my mom figured, like, since it said that specific hospital, like, take her to that hospital. So I went back to the hospital because I was losing weight and I was in extreme pain. We had a small dose of pain meds at home and they weren't helping. Tylenol wasn't working, ibuprofen, anything. It was just not working. So I was in a lot of pain and not tolerating my feeds at all. So they took me to the hospital and it was a hospital that didn't know me. I was admitted at that time for pain and then also trying to figure out my feeds, like maybe a different formula or whatever, maybe a different mixture. And at this time, I had suspected mitochondrial disease by the age of 12 because I was just not recovering from things. So I was having blood tests that were showing signs of mitochondrial disease, but I did not have a geneticist at this time to say, yeah, that's mitochondrial disease. I just had like my normal doctors, like a gastroenterologist, immunologist, like a primary doctor. So we were working on getting a geneticist, but we didn't have one at this time. So on my paperwork, we put suspected mitochondrial disease. We never said that I had it for sure, but right now they were treating me as such since I was having so many symptoms of it. They're giving me more vitamins that people would get in like their mito cocktail, and then also trying to avoid mitotoxic meds that I talked about previously. Mm. And during this time, they tried to give me an antipsychotic because they didn't really believe me. This was a completely new hospital. They got my medical records, but they were just like, no, we don't believe her. So they thought it was really all in my head. They diagnosed me with somatoform disorder, which is a valid diagnosis, but I do not have it. It means like stress. It basically means it's all in your head. Like stress is what's causing your illness. And there's no medical proof of what's causing my illness. It's just all in my head, basically. And then at this time, they tried to give me an antipsychotic. That antipsychotic being on the minor toxic list. And as I said, they were treating me as if I had it. So my mom was like, no, you're not putting her on that medication. It's minor toxic. And then they were like, no, it's fine. And then they asked the pharmacist, like, can somebody with mito have this? And they said, no, because it works on your mitochondria. That's what makes a mitotoxic med mitotoxic. So she said, no, we're not doing that. And then also I was in excruciating pain at this point. Like, I have a decent pain tolerance and I've never rated pain like a 10. Like, that's extreme to me. But I was rating this pain a 9. Nothing they were giving me was really like working. So my parents were saying like, this isn't working. Like, if Tylenol wasn't working, then we wouldn't be here. So they said that my parents were trying to give me pain meds, like opioids. And then they also said at this time that my parents were neglecting treatment for me. And then since I was in excruciating pain, like the last thing you're going to do is have like a full conversation with somebody. So my parents, as parents normally do, advocated for me, because having a child with chronic illness, like, that's one of the like important things you can do, because nobody knows your child like you do. Like, a doctor who just met your child isn't going to fully understand them. So my parents would tell them, like, I'm in a lot of pain. I would show that I'm in a lot of pain, but they didn't really believe it. And they said that my parents were trying to speak for me instead of like seeing that a parent is trying to advocate for their child. So at this point, they started suspecting my parents for Munchausen by proxy, which Munchausen by proxy, it is when a caregiver or parent or whoever is making their child or whoever they're caring for sick. So all of my issues were not caused by mitochondrial disease like they suspected, Ehlers-Danlos like I was diagnosed with, peripheral neuropathy. No, it was all my parents making it up and making me sick. So at this time, they got DCS involved, and I was still admitted. And during this time, it was mainly for observation.
And then, at this point, how old are you?
I was 13.
So for our listeners, everything that Skylar has told us about her background has happened prior to the age of 13.
Correct.
I mean, this is,
yes, because I
significant.
I remember I spent my 13th birthday in the hospital when I was recovering from sepsis, actually. I got a PICC line placed on my birthday. It was
terrible. What a present.
Yeah, what an amazing present.
And I mean, back to, if you really think about like a child laying in a hospital, I have a 12-year-old son myself. I mean, if you really do think about it, especially when they're sick, they're not trying to talk to adult strangers.
Yes. And they would ask me like kind of leading questions. Like, they were very, very, very strange with me. And then during this time, it was just observation. They were observing my behavior, my parents' behavior. And then at the hospital, you get like an attending doctor and then like a resident. And the attending is like who makes all the decisions. So during this time, I got a new attending doctor. And he was so amazing. I have so much love for him still. And this was October 29th, 2017, and I was 13 years old. And on October 29th, he put in discharge paperwork, and he said that her parents are not making her sick. Like, this is just valid. And then
you thought you were going to go home.
Yes, we had all of our bags packed and everything. And also, sorry for skipping over some things, but I still was in my wheelchair at this point. But I would only use it for long distances, as in like going out somewhere. Like, I could walk to the bathroom. I could walk to the car. But due to all my fatigue and pain and muscle weakness, I couldn't walk that far. Even though I was in physical therapy at this point, it still was very hard. So we had all of our bags packed. We were actually going out of the hospital room to go to the car to leave. And then at this point, they were just like, no, you can't leave. DCS is now completely involved. So we were just like, okay. And we didn't really know what to expect.
You didn't understand probably the depth of what they were orchestrating on their side of things.
Correct. I just knew like they didn't really believe me, but I don't know these doctors. So It was whatever.
And you were a child. So
exactly.
I'm sure your bandwidth of what could be imagined was probably less than,
Yes. No, it was so scary. And also at this time I had a therapy dog and she was approved to go to hospitals with me and just basically lay in bed for comfort and everything. And fast forward to the next day, October 30th, it's 8 p.m. at this time. I remember it so vividly. And they asked my mom to go on a walk and chat with them. It was a caseworker and Child Life. What Child Life is in Children's Hospital, it's just basically the fun people. They bring you crafts and everything for distractions. And it was the caseworker and Child Life. The caseworker went with my mom to go take a walk. And it had been a minute, like it was about like 10 minutes. And I was just like, what's going on? Like, where's my mom? And then they're just like, oh, they're just chatting. And then next thing I know, within another about like 5 minutes, a bunch of security, sheriffs, and cops come in my room. They even had canine dogs. And they start grabbing my mom's stuff. And they were like, is this your mom's stuff? And I was like, yeah, but why do you need it? And then they didn't give me any answers. They were just grabbing her stuff. And my heart started racing. I remember it. And then they were just like, we need your dog too. Like, your dog can't stay here. And I was just like, what do you mean my dog can't stay here? They, instead of picking my dog up and taking her, they took her by her leash and she was choking, like begging for breath. And they're just like just taking her like that. And I started crying because they're just taking everything from me. And at this point,
you really had no idea what was going on.
Absolutely none.
Yeah.
Like I was 13 and completely clueless. They didn't really tell me anything.
The idea of what was to come probably wasn't even in your wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm. No, I had no idea because my parents, after talking to them when I got older, they knew that DCS was involved. They knew all of this, but they didn't want to scare me, which I do appreciate because it would have been a lot worse if I knew kind of what was going on at that point. But they were just taking my stuff. And then I was looking at the Child Life lady and I was just like, what is going on? Because I didn't like any of these people in there. I actually really did not like that Child Life person the entire time. Just because I was 13 and she talked to me like I was like 3 years old, kind of. And it just annoyed me so much.
Yeah.
But they took her stuff. And at this point, I had a little iPad. And I was texting my mom on like probably like Messenger, Facebook Messenger or something.
Yeah.
And I was just like, they're taking your stuff. What is going on? And she said, I'm so sorry. Like, we'll get you back soon. And I was just like, what does that mean? Like, I had no idea what that meant. And then they moved me to a different room on a different floor. And I remember the next day was Halloween. And I was just so confused. Like, I didn't really get much sleep that night because I was so confused. And I was like, am I going to see my parents again? Like, am I going to go home? And they
and
said
no one was being transparent with you.
They said that I would see my parents, but that I wouldn't go home. Because I do understand from a level, like, you're not supposed to tell, like, a child, like, absolutely everything that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But I was asking them questions and none of them except that one question was being answered that I would see them again, but they didn't know if I would ever go home again. And then at this time, they started being really mean to me, honestly. They would come in by an attending doctor, a different doctor from the one that tried to discharge me. They wouldn't let him on my case anymore. It seemed like every single doctor, nurse, CNA, sitter that I liked, that I would say like, oh, I like them, I would never see them again. Like, it was just mean. And I was 13 again at this time. And I remember them starting to come into my room, like the doctors, and they would start yelling at me, like literally yelling, like, "You are a faker. Your parents are making you sick. Like, we don't believe your pain. It's all in your head. Like, you don't need the medications. You don't need that feeding tube." Basically, just that everything was a lie. And I would just kind of look at them and I would be like, "I know that I need this feeding tube. Like, I've tried to eat. I throw up. I'm nauseous. Like, this is the way that I've been getting nutrition since I was 11 years old. And, you know," and then they're just like, your parents are making you so sick. And they're just cruel to me. And then at this time, about 4 days of being taken, they put a sitter in my room, which is a person that stays with you. They would swap out every 12 hours. So I would have a day sitter and a night sitter, which they give people who have suicidal ideation normally. And I had none. I was very depressed, but every time they would ask me, like, "Do you have suicidal thoughts?" blah, 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 I would always say no. And then the sitter would come in there, stay in there. And I remember the night ones were the worst, because I would move in bed and they would stand up and look at me. And then they would like come closer and just like watch me sleep. They would have food in front of me and I was really depressed. I had no appetite. And again, I would throw everything up and it just wasn't great. And they would make me like watch the food and sit up with that. And then some of the sitters would like eat the food, which, you know, it was going to go to waste anyways, but that was really interesting to me.
But you didn't have the sitters in your room until your mom was taken by the police. Okay.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. So how many days were you in the hospital with these sitters?
The entire time I was in the hospital after my mom got removed, obviously. And then a week goes past, and every single time, because the doctors would come into my room, they had this psych team. Uh-huh. It was about 4 to 6 doctors, and they were all just psychological doctors, and they would come in and ask me just a bunch of questions. And I've always been like pretty sassy and everything, and like very stubborn. I'm a very stubborn person. And they would ask me questions. I would not answer them. I would not give them any answers. I would be really passive aggressive with them, because I wasn't stupid. I really wasn't. And I could tell like some of their questions were kind of leading questions. And they're also being passive aggressive to my parents, which I
Well, and you had no reason to trust them.
Exactly. No, I didn't trust any person in that hospital at all. And then a week goes past, and every single day, multiple times a day, I would ask when I could see my parents, when I could talk to my parents. I didn't have my dog. I didn't have my phone to talk to anybody. I couldn't talk to my friends. I had no communication with any of my friends at this point. And then a week goes past, and out of nowhere, a DCS officer comes into my room, and he's like, "I'm going to take you to go see your parents." So they took me in my wheelchair because I couldn't really walk that much at this point, especially. And then they took me to see my parents, and my face just lit up every single time. I remember at first, this first visit, they separated them. It was my dad and my uncle, actually. And then also the next one, and that was for 15 minutes. I got to see my dad and uncle. And then they left. And then the next 15 minutes, I got to see my mom and my brother and my aunt. So that was just great. Like, I remember the psych team would come in and I was just like, "Yeah, I was really happy yesterday. I got to see my parents. First time I was happy, like, since I'd been here," which I forgot to mention. I got admitted here on October 17th and I got taken on October 30th. And then at this point, it was early November. And I still had no answers. A lot of doctors would come into my room. Like, I remember when I got older and I was looking at like the notes that they left, because they always leave like progress notes. And all the doctors and nurses, they have to sign off. And I would have like 16 in just one day. Different nurses, different doctors, different sitters, different CNAs, which CNAs just like kind of take your vitals and everything. But the CNAs are also like the sitter. But another probably 4 days went past, And I got to see my parents again, and they said that I would start getting regular visits, which it was 1 hour for a week. And they couldn't come into my hospital room at this point at all. They couldn't know where I was. And then at the visit, like, I started crying and I got like emotional because I was really happy to see my parents. And they pulled me aside away from my parents, the DCS officer, to talk to me. And she said, you can't cry to your parents. Like, they're probably sad during this point. You're going to make it worse. And then they would tell me that my parents couldn't ask about any of my medical, anything that was happening. They couldn't even ask like how I was feeling, because that would be like, oh, like, I'm not feeling good, like, I'm in pain. They couldn't know that. They also could not show emotion because it was a very emotional time seeing them again after not seeing them for so long. And then also what I've had to endure, which is doctors yelling at me and telling me all of these things that I knew weren't true. I knew my parents weren't making me sick. But I did start at this point, like, kind of doubting myself, like, what did I do wrong? Like, is this all in my head? But I knew for a 100% fact my parents were not making me sick. And then started having regular visits, 1 hour every week. And we would have them at this little, it was actually very pretty, this little garden they had outside or downstairs, because I was on the sixth floor. So it was downstairs. They had this like meditation room, which was very nice. I actually enjoyed it. And then from everything, from them messing with my feeds, which was 100% of my nutrition and everything, I started getting weaker. And they were also neglecting some of the treatments that I have previously were getting, like the Mito cocktail and everything. And I stopped being able to walk at all. I was not paralyzed, but my legs, like, I was just too weak and too much pain to where when I could walk, when I did walk small distances, like even to the bathroom, I would need a walker because I couldn't support myself anymore. I couldn't walk at all. I was not paralyzed, but I was just extremely, extremely sick and malnourished and everything. And it was really interesting because they said my parents were making me sick, but in their care, all I was doing was getting sicker. Because I went in there, like, I could walk small distances. I could no longer do that. And then about mid-November, my parents had a placement court, which I was placed in foster care now. I was placed with this family, which they were a very great family to their knowledge, because DCS would obviously tell them, you're like, yeah, she's a faker. She has probably trauma from her parents, even though all of my trauma is from doctors. And
the situation sounds pretty traumatic.
It most definitely was.
It has nothing to do with your parents.
Exactly. The only time I was like happy was when I would see my parents, but whatever.
You're under the impression that you're, you know, get inching closer to being with them more regularly with your parents. And then they throw this on you that you're going to a foster family.
See, with that, I never had like hopes with it. Like, I knew that they could just one day like say like, no, she can't see her family again. So I tried not to keep that much. Like, I tried to keep hope that I was going home always, but I didn't want to get my hopes up too high.
Understandable. Yeah.
Yeah. I was always scared that they would just take away visits. I was scared that I would never see my family again. I was scared that I would be put up for adoption, because going to foster care like that, that's a big deal. Like, I asked, as I said previously, like, my aunt and my uncle came to see me, and I was like, could I be placed with my aunt? Like, please. And they said, oh, maybe we'll look into it. But they didn't look into it at all, because my aunt, she was emailing them like, hey, because she was safe and everything. She emailed them. She got no response. So then at this time, I was placed in foster care, which my foster parents, they were very sweet to their knowledge, because DCS obviously was telling them like, yeah, she's a faker, blah, blah, blah. So they didn't really treat me as a faker. They would like encourage me to get better, which I appreciate. Like, that's what my parents want too. But they were nice to their knowledge. And then in foster care, I started getting more sick. I was running fevers at this time, and I was turning, like, my fatigue was really bad. I was getting really sick. So they brought me to urgent care, and I kept telling like the foster dad, I was like, I don't need urgent care. Like, I need to go to the emergency room. Like, I really do not feel good. So he brought me to urgent care, and they transported me to an actual hospital, like an ER. And it was funny because they said like my parents were over medicalizing me at this point, taking me to different facilities because I got like my muscle biopsy done in Wisconsin. That's where we lived until I was 9 years old. And then when I turned 9, we moved to Arizona. And in Arizona, we went to a couple different hospitals, about including the one that I got taken from, about three.
Well, you mentioned that you ended up having to go to a new hospital from your insurance changing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And then they said that they were over-medicalizing me, DCS did, but they took me to a different hospital.
So they furthered their, what they were against.
And then they said they were also wanting to redo my medical testing that I did, but they said that my parents were over-medicalizing me, but whatever. And then they brought
me to nuts.
It's crazy. And then they brought me to a different hospital. I got transported via an ambulance, but it was just like a transporting ambulance. So no like flashing lights. It was just for transport. It was my first time being in an ambulance too. And then in that hospital, they just did like monitoring, but they had a heart rate thing on my finger 24/7. And I remember waking up one day and my heart was like going like weird. And then the machine like started going and my heart rate was at 30. Like I was not doing good. And I have POTS. So normally my heart rate is kind of higher and my heart rate was going pretty low. And I remember it was starting to get hard to like sit up for long periods of time. So like even sitting up for the visits that I had with my family, it was difficult. But also at the court hearing for foster care, when I got put on there, they gave my parents more visits. So I was getting visits at a DCS office now, since I was in foster care now. I was getting those twice a week for 1 to 2 hours. But again, if we showed emotion or anything, the visit would be cut short and I would just go home and stuff. My parents would bring me things.
But think about like, how much emotion you must have felt and your parents must have felt seeing each other. You're a child and they're not able to be with you daily. So, I mean, they're asking the impossible.
Yeah. And this was the sickest that I've ever been. And my parents weren't there. Like, they were terrified. They were so scared.
I can't imagine what life was like for, I mean, you're describing it very well, but I can't imagine what life was like for the three of you and for your brother. For, this is very scary.
Yeah, with me, it was just, this was my life. And I didn't really have any schooling at this point either. None at all in foster care. And then at the hospital, they would give me schoolwork for about a third grader when I was in seventh grade. And they would say that they were doing that because my mental capacity was that, because my voice, I had a high voice when I was younger. But if they actually did like the testing, like I was at normal base with my educational level, but they would give me like third grade paperwork and stuff like that. So they could say to the judges, oh yeah, she's only capable of doing like third grade.
So what brought you back to your parents permanently?
Court. And they got a lawyer, which they had to pay for. And then they also finally got a geneticist. But what brought me back is they had another court hearing. It was about 2 weeks into being in foster care. They had a court hearing and they got a lawyer at this point. And then they also got a geneticist on my case. And the geneticist I got, he looked through all of my paperwork and he would not take me on if he did not believe that I was actually sick, or if my parents were making me sick, he would not take me on. But he looked through my paperwork. He looked through the blood test. Obviously, the muscle biopsy was thrown out the window. That was inconclusive. But the blood tests and everything, and just my medical history in general. And he diagnosed me clinically at this point with mitochondrial disease. So I finally got the clinical diagnosis. And then after that, I went into foster care mid-November, and it was coming to the end of November, early December. And the mom there, she kept asking me like, oh, what do you want for Christmas? And the only thing I would say was to go home. Like, that's it I would say. And she was just like, well, something I could give you. And I was just like, that's it I want. Like, I don't care about a
you
Christmas
probably didn't
present.
Want to picture a Christmas at their house.
Yeah.
As nice as they were.
No, they were very nice, but they weren't my family,
right.
You know?
And you knew there was no reason to not be with your family.
Exactly. I knew
that
my parents...
And I'm sure you were itching to, I mean, while you were sick still, but I'm sure you're thinking about, like, getting back to school and, you know, to your life.
Yeah, my friends or anything. Like, I didn't have a life at all. And they said that my parents would stop me from having a life, but this was the least of a life that I've ever had. So with my family, I had homeschooling. I had a teacher that would come to my house because I was too sick to go to school. And I would have friends that would come over to my house because most of the time I'd be too sick to go to their house or go to like an outing or something like that. But they accommodated to me. They wanted me to have friends. They wanted me to have a social life and everything. But they didn't see that because they just saw a sick girl. And
yeah, they saw what they wanted to see.
Yeah, exactly. And the big thing was my mom refusing that medication because they said it was refusing care. But on December 6th, they had court where they talked to my geneticist, the judge did, and then their lawyer, and they were granted physical custody at this time, but not legal custody. So I was home physically, but they had no say over any of my healthcare. DCS would just randomly come to my appointments, like, because they knew it on their schedule. They were just always in my life. Like, I didn't really have that much freedom, honestly. And then from December 2017 to May of 2018, I was still in their physical, but not legal custody. And we had to go to trial, a 2-day trial at the Supreme Court for this. And my geneticist testified. The psychologist that I would see outpatient at my normal hospital was also there. And then my mom and dad's lawyer, and then also their people. So their district attorney, their DCS people. And then also one of the doctors who were at the bad hospital, the hospital that took me. Uh-huh. And during this point, when I was seeing my therapist, psychologist, he diagnosed me with PTSD from it. I would have nightmares. I still am terrified of hospitals. I would
justifiably.
No, most definitely. And then I remember the first day, it was mainly just their side testifying. So it was just the district attorney, DCS, unfortunately that doctor, and it was just them testifying. And I remember that they were just like, yeah, we got it, like this day, like they thought that they were going to win. And then the next day was our day, and it was my mom and dad's lawyer a lot and my geneticist. And I remember the second day, like, they were like, whatever, and my geneticist was the last to testify. And after he testified, like, the room was quiet. Like, it was genuinely just, oh my gosh, I forgot to include that when I was in their physical, not legal custody, we had a mandated psychological evaluation to see if my mom had traits of Munchausen by proxy, because this psychologist, that was his sole specialty, was Munchausen by proxy. And he was a psychologist that they flew out from California, actually. And he did a psychological evaluation on me, my mom, and my dad. And he found that my mom does not have Munchausen by proxy. He basically found nothing. He said that he did say that I had oral aversion at this time. ARFRID, it's called, avoidant restrictive intake disorder, but my geneticist testified over that because that is a mental condition. And since I have physical proof physical proof that my oral aversion at this time was because I was constantly nauseous from my feeds because they were going into my intestines, and I had very bad dysmotility. So I was always nauseous. So I didn't even want food. I would really stick to just like clear liquids and stuff like that. Sometimes soft foods, but really not that much. But I couldn't have ARFID since I had a medical reason for it. It had to be like psychological. Like, it's like a lot of quote picky eaters have it and stuff like that. And then he testified too that my parents weren't making me sick. Like, it was a 3 to 4, I think it was a 3.5 hour evaluation. We were there for so long. I hated it. I remember I dreaded it because I found out a month before we were having that. Just, I knew nothing. I mean,
sure, it was like a dark cloud just like hanging over you, knowing that you had to get through that.
Yes, no, I was so scared. And it was just dreadful. But that got over. And then in trial, he testified that my mom's not making me sick. And then my geneticist testified. And it was just up to the judge. Like, it wasn't a jury thing. And the judge granted my parents physical and legal custody. So it was legally over. Thank gosh. Yes, it was legally over, but it was not physically or mentally over.
Yeah.
It dragged on. Like, I'm 20 years old now and I'm still terrified of doctors. I'm still terrified of hospitals and everything. I still struggle with very bad PTSD.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, you can remember it all so vividly, which I think is just proof that, you know, a lot of adults, you know, or 20 somethings can't remember these specific details from that age. And you can.
Yes. No. And I remember like time stamps. Like, I remember I got taken.
Yeah. You're really good with dates. Yeah.
8 p.m.
Yeah. So how are your parents? I mean, they have. You never want to be questioned as a parent, you know, and that was like the end of the rope of what they had to have experienced in their. The way they questioned themselves and the way everyone was questioning them, it had to have been so traumatic.
Yes. I didn't really know how traumatic it was for them at this point. Like, I did feel bad, but I'm sure you're older,
understanding that more and more now. Yeah.
As I got older, we talked through it. This was my parents, like, it was very mentally difficult to them. And that was a big, big part that led to their divorce after 16 years. Because it was just so difficult. My mom, she told me like when I was taken that she started like going through everything like in her head. She was like, was I over medicalizing her? Like, what did I do wrong? And she genuinely couldn't come up with anything. And after talking, the geneticist I got before I met him, because they got him when I was taken. She was asking him questions like, was this wrong? Was this wrong? It completely destroyed my dad. Like, I have never seen my dad cry until those moments. My mom, it was terrible because as like, obviously, I don't know from their perspective because I was the sick one. But as a parent with a child with chronic illness, I remember when I was in the hospital and I felt bad because I would look over and my mom would just look so scared. She would look so scared. And as a parent of a child with chronic illness, like, all you want is for them to get better. Like, I know if my parents had one wish, it would be for me to just like magically get better. And it was blamed on her, even though all she's done is like try to figure everything out, you know?
Yeah. That is so heavy. Mm-hmm. I am so sorry that is in your past.
It is really difficult.
And it's a part of your present, right?
Yeah. No, I was just hospitalized the end of last month, beginning of this month. And I was having panic attacks all the time. I had to get a psychologist there, and she was amazing. She accommodated to my PTSD, like for my triggers, which were like the white coats they would wear, and then a bunch of doctors in the room. If I just feel like a doctor is questioning me, it's complete tears, which doesn't look right on their paper. And then when I'm in the hospital, my mom tries to be there as much as possible, but she does have work, obviously. But she tries to be there, and when they'll like talk to me a lot when my mom's not there, which I'm 20 years old, but it's still really scary. And my mom does not talk to the doctors really at all. She does not, she barely brings up concerns because she's scared to.
Yeah.
She's scared to say, like, if I'm feeling something. Like, after this, she had like a long talk with me when I was 13. And oh, I was 14 at this time. Sorry. My birthday was in May, but I was 14.
I'm glad you were back with your family for your birthday.
Yes, me too. And Christmas. Big for Christmas. But she had a talk with me, and she was just like, you know, I can't talk for you anymore. Like, I know you're 14, you're still a minor, but I can't talk for you. If you are in pain, you have to tell them. You have to verbalize everything. I remember at my last admission, they were just like, so mom, what do you think? And she was just like, you know, do what you need to. And like, she doesn't agree with some things that they'll do, but she's terrified to even advocate for
me. I can't imagine not being like that after all
exactly,
of this.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know?
No, it's terrifying.
So did you go back to school the following school year, or did you remain homeschooled?
So I remained homeschooled in eighth grade, which was about almost a year after it. I tried to go to public school and then try to like accommodate to me, because I couldn't do 5 days a week. So I would do like two to three, and then I would do the rest online. But I couldn't even tolerate that. I was in a lot of physical therapy and everything at this time, trying to rebuild my strength, relearn how to basically walk, because I was just, my legs were noodles. Like, it was really bad. But I did eventually. And then I was also put back on my normal medications, nerve pain medications. And then also, since I got the geneticist who specializes in mitochondrial disease, he put me on the correct mitococktail, because at this point, we were just doing like random CoQ10s and stuff like that. But now it was like a mitococktail, and it was helping a lot. And then also under his care, I started to improve, but I was still just doing homeschooling.
Uh-huh.
After
this whole episode, you went back to homeschooling. So now, looking at your life today, do you trust friends? Do you feel like you have issues with trust beyond the doctors and nurses?
Sometimes, but it's really not terrible. It's kind of like some of those doctors, like, they would ask me, like, they would try, some of them, there was some that were just blatantly mean, like they would scream at me and stuff. But there was about two or three that would play like the nice guy, but you would look at their paperwork and it was mean. But they would play nice, and then I looked at their paperwork and it was mean. So it's just like, are some people just kind of like playing me? You know, as in like, they're just acting nice, but they really have ill intent.
Mm-hmm.
But it's mainly with medical professionals, with my trust.
I'm glad it doesn't bleed. Those fears don't bleed outside of the medical community. I'm sorry that you do feel that way with your doctors and nurses, but at least it doesn't go beyond that, you know?
Yes.
I want to know too about Skylar with beyond the disease. You know, I want our listeners to know who you are today outside the disease.
I like to do like random things. Like, I like crafty things. I'm getting into college this year. I mean, next year.
Great.
Yes. I'm really excited. And I don't know what really I'm going to do with my life. I'm still 20. So I have some time to figure it out. A lot of the like careers that I would like to go by, I can't physically do because of my condition.
Yeah.
But I will definitely find something that accommodates to me. And I'm excited to go back to school with like college, and I'm doing it online. So I'm excited for that. And then school started being really struggling, so I took a break, and I ended up just getting my GED, which is the equivalent to a high school diploma. I couldn't do it all. So I got my GED, and then looking into like college and stuff like that. But I like to do just like random things, honestly.
Well, I'm glad that you were able to get your GED. I mean, what you went through was so intense. If you told me right now you didn't finish high school, I would understand. And, you know, that you didn't receive an alternative degree, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm so proud of who you are today.
Thank
knowing
you.
That all of what you've experienced, I wish I had better words for it. I'm so perplexed that it all spiraled like this, you know?
It's really crazy. And I think it's very disturbing to me now how Munchausen by proxy is just thrown around. And there's a new term for it, which is medical child abuse. Uh-huh. And I think that this really, because this was 2017, I think this all really started with the Gypsy Rose Blanchard case.
Yeah.
With her mom making her severely sick, like faking cancer. Like, that's insane, getting her teeth out and everything. And the doctors never really caught it until it got to where she couldn't take it anymore. So doctors are trying to kind of find it early, if that makes sense, and try to get it early. But a lot of it just is just wrongfully done. I've looked into it, and there's more cases of medical kidnapping than there are of actual Munchausen by proxy. And I do feel like this, some people might think this is a stretch, but it's really not. I feel like some doctors, medical professionals use the medical child abuse and how easy it is to take away kids. I think they use it as if you strike like their ego, if that makes sense, because my mom saying, no, don't put her on that medication, that's not good for her. And them saying like, oh no, it's fine. Like she's kind of questioning them. Like, they went to medical school, they should know better and stuff like that. So it's like if you even question doctors at this point, it's automatically there's something wrong
with
you.
How many times have all of us gone to a doctor and they're not even familiar with mitochondrial disease, you know?
So many.
So it's like, we do have to question
what
they're doing, you know? I mean, anytime before I go under anesthesia, I want to talk to the anesthesiologist, and nurses question me about it. And I mean, it's really difficult, you know? I mean, to have a rare disease, number one, and then to feel second-guessed and questioned. I mean, I've never experienced it on your level, but I really can't imagine. And I really appreciate you sharing your story.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a difficult story to share. And it happened when I was 13 and I'm 20 now. And I honestly didn't talk about it until really this year, when I started seeing so many cases of it. And like, so many. It's actually crazy. I'm in this group and they share a new story every single day of just them taking their kids, and some don't get their kids back. I forgot to include this, but they actually, the doctors wanted to send me to a different state because they didn't have, quote, the psychological care I needed, because they said that I had trauma from my parents, and they said that all of this is in my head, this somatoform disorder, and that I think that I have this and I don't. And they would come into my room and they would be like, you don't have mitochondrial disease. I was like, I don't care. Like, I do not care. I just want my parents. I don't care what you say I have. You can say I have some somatoform disorder if I can go home. I don't care. Because I felt my pain. I knew it was real.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, it's just like, they're medical professionals. Like, what if it's not real? But I was like, I feel this pain. Like, it's real.
Right, right. I'm glad that you do have a diagnosis. There's a lot of people that have mitochondrial disease, but they're not showing, you know, in genetic testing. So I'm glad that that is not your case, because you deserve the justification.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a heavy diagnosis, though.
It is.
But it's a great to have like an answer to my problems. And for if they question me, I have mitochondrial disease. But at the same time, it took me so long to get diagnosed. I had genetic sequencing done when I was 17, and that showed 3 gene mutations, and I can't fake 3 gene mutations. Right. My parents can't come up with 3 gene mutations. I'm sorry. But I had that, and it sucked, but it was kind of like validation, I guess.
Yeah.
Because I still have health problems, obviously. Hasn't gone away at all. And also through my story, like, mitochondrial disease is just so up and down. but I have my good days and I have my very bad days. I still go to hospitals and I still have panic attacks there all the time because it's just terrifying. But no, it's a very up and down diagnosis, as in like I got decently better when I was 8 years old and then I got extremely sick when I was 11.
Right.
And then my digestive tract just kind of never recovered from there.
It's a very heavy lifestyle. It's a very isolating lifestyle. And I think that's why this podcast is so important, because we need to hear each other's stories so that we're reminded that we are not alone, no matter how much it may feel like that, you know?
Most definitely. No, this podcast is great and you do so beautiful at it.
Oh, thank you.
No,
Skylar,
you're welcome.
It was so good to have you.
It was so good to talk to you.
So much luck with college. And
thank you.
You are going to do such good things. You have so much passion and I feel so lucky to be connected with you.
Oh, thank you. That's so sweet.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I am so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.